We're randomly selecting listener reviews to read on the show, and if we choose yours, you'll get free Single Tracks merch in the mail. This week, we're sharing a recent review from KKR5 Fan. KKR5 Fan writes, "Content is solid with good reviews and writing advice that are data as well as experience-based. Just purchased an Orbea Rayon based off podcast discussion and Single Tracks reviews." Well, KKR5 Fan, we hope you're enjoying that bike. If you could send us an email at info@singletracks.com, we'll get your shipping information and your goodies out. Be sure to add your review of the Single Tracks podcast wherever you listen to our show. Thanks and happy trails.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Single Tracks podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is Enrico Guala. He's the founder of Italy's Super Enduro Series and an Enduro World Series board member. He also owns a bicycle distribution company based in Italy. Thanks for joining us, Enrico.
Yeah, nice to be with you, Jeff. Been listening to your podcast for quite some time, and yeah, good to be here.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So you've been mountain biking for a long time and even spent several years as a trials rider. What got you interested in the sport and bicycles in general?
Well, I've been doing trials before discovering and founding, you know, mountain bikes. And it basically was an accident that, you know, drove my life. Bad accident. I was hit by a car when I was 4 years old.
Ooh.
And when it was a pretty serious accident, you know, I crossed the road where I shouldn't, mm-hmm. and kind of escaping from my parents. And, you know, I was in a pretty bad shape that time. Yeah. And, you know, my parents kind of, you know, got very, very impressed. And when it was time, when I turned 14 years old, and that's usually the age when you can start driving a motorcycle, you know, a 50cc motorcycle in Italy. And we're living in a small village on the hills just above Genova. I asked for a motorcycle. It was my time. And I said, you know, we're not really sure if we want you again, you know, in danger.
Yeah.
And so I said, wow, but, you know, I wanted something. It was my, you know, I was kind of finishing school, and, you know, for summertime, usually parents buy either a motorcycle or an Ape, but that's another story. Or, you know, I wanted a bicycle. And, you know, there were these Montezita bicycle made by Pedro P, the mm-hmm. father of Hot P. He was a frame builder at Montesa and just, you know, was doing these trial bikes. And I was very, you know, interested in trial bikes, because in the village there were motorcycle trial riders. Mm-hmm. So I said to my parents, well, why don't you get me a trial bike? And so they did. And I started to, you know, living in the countryside, like hit any little wall, rocks,
yeah.
Logs, everything, and trying, you know, to go over the obstacles, you know, with this bike, with the wrong technique in the beginning. And then I moved to some races and went to see some races, and I said, oh, wow, the technique is completely different. You know, those guys are like actually hopping their bikes. You know, they're not using the speed mm-hmm. to go over the obstacles. So I started to be involved in trial racing, and, you know, to make a long story short, started to race in, I think it was 84, mm-hmm. 1984. And basically did Italian series and been, you know, quite good in that sport.
Yeah.
And the local shop where I used to buy my spare parts in Genova, a couple of years later, I was there just to buy stuff or do some maintenance on my bike. Mm-hmm. And I saw those big wheel off-road bikes.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, what's that? You know, it's like, and this guy, the owner of the shop, was really into BMX at the moment,
mm-hmm.
At that time. And he said, well, you know, it's like a BMX with way bigger wheels and gears, and you can just climb up the mountain, you know, easily and then go down. And he got me a mountain bike. It was a GT Backwoods, 18
oh, cool.
speed, pull moose, a bunch of other super high level components.
Yeah.
And I decided it was my thing. Like, I bought it. Actually, my parents did. And I started to ride my mountain bike on top of my trial.
Oh, wow. Yeah, on your courses.
Yeah, well, it was a different thing. Mm-hmm. I didn't give up or quit trials. Actually, I did my best season trials in 89. And then I started to mountain bike, mainly as a discovery thing. Because my trial bike, I was able to do, good stuff, uh-huh. jump over stuff and, into the section and then, train for the sport and having good results. But what mountain bike was representing to me at the time, it was a long ride. I could actually reach way, way, way farther than with my trial bike.
Yeah. Sort of like the motorcycle that you wanted.
Exactly. Well, instead of putting fuel, I had to eat a lot of pasta to go far, but it was good.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that your parents, I guess, thought it was okay to get you a trials bike and later a mountain bike. They didn't see that as being too dangerous. I mean, do you think there is sort of a different level of risk between motorcycles and mountain biking, say?
I think that the main thing for them, and which is something that I actually understand, and I think the same now, it's that when you drive your motorcycle on the road, on open traffic, you're responsible for what you do, but there's a lot of elements
right.
of the environment that you can't control. Like, I don't want to talk about, people using their phones in the cars, which is right. something that I see every day,
Yeah.
And I can be super careful, on a cross or when I ride my bike on the road, but someone can hit me just because, mm-hmm. I can't control it. So I think that was their main concern at the time.
Yeah. Trees and rocks, I guess, they tend to stay where they are and they don't make unpredictable moves.
Well, sometimes trees cross the trail suddenly. something.
Yeah, that's true.
You don't expect it happened a couple of times, but yeah, but it's sort of a safer environment where you can actually, decide the, level of danger you're living.
Yeah.
The speed and when something is starting to go wrong, or when you're right above your limit. I think you went through that for sure.
Right.
Like all mountain biker did. It's happening. So
yeah, that's great. So how did you start your race series, the Super Enduro?
Ooh, yeah. That was kind of an evolution of my job, because after the trial and being involved in mountain biking, I started to, my job as a mechanic in a mm-hmm. bike shop, and yeah. then as a sales guy, and then as an agent, and then I started to work with companies. And while selling products for a small Italian manufacturer called STM, but I think I can tell you the story a bit later, maybe. I met a guy in Alba. He had a bike shop, Franco Monchiero, and he was already racing mountain bike at the time. And so that's the first time I met him. And, we kind of like each other and, get along very well together. And then we found ourselves working together again a few years later in Finale, in a distribution company we used to work with. And so, knowing each other more and more, we started to work on a project. Actually, it was already organizing DH events, downhill events, mm-hmm. with my bike shop.
Yeah.
I thought it was a very good way to, push people above their limits so they could change bikes and stuff on their bikes. But I was also very, very attracted and driven by gravity and speed and this part of the sport, the gravity side of mountain biking. So few years after, we started working together, I opened my distribution company for GWIMP, and that was 2006. And he was working at the time for Commensal. So we both quit the distribution company in Finale and, went on separate projects. And 2004, 2005, it was the beginning of the mega avalanche and, the avalanche series, downhill mass start downhill events,
mm-hmm.
and brands like Commensal, basically the development of their bikes, their newest bike, like the Meta, there was a Meta 6 I think or 5 at the moment, at the time, based on this type of racing. And Franco was selling Commensal and I was starting to sell Ibis, and Ibis just presented the year before the Mojo, which was a 140 mil all mountain bike, you know, full carbon that people really at the moment, they at least in Italy, no one understood what the bike was for.
Yeah.
You have to know, Jeff, that Italy is a race-driven country. We race everything. You know, we have Ferrari, yeah. We have Ducati, we race on the highway, we race girls, we race everything. And it's in our blood. It's in the DNA of this country. And so if I need to look for a sport tool or an equipment, I want to know what's this for in a racing environment.
Yeah.
Like I'm going to buy my ski, you know, my new ski, because there's someone racing those skis in World Cup level, you know? And
yeah.
When Alberto Tomba used to win World Cup, he was on yellow Rossignol and everybody had yellow Rossignol ski. So at the time, you know, the only disciplines that we had in Italy on mountain bike were cross country, and we had perfect bike for cross country, and downhill, and mm-hmm. there were downhill bikes. But yeah. those bikes were like, you know, transgender, if you know my meaning, like, you know, in between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what do you do with these bikes?
Right. Well, a lot of people were wondering that too. I mean, it wasn't just Italy where there was only XC and downhill. I mean, it was, you know, around this time, there wasn't really anything else there in terms of competition, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So you have to know that in Europe, France is always leading the trend, especially when you talk about, you know, action sport or, you know, innovation into sport and outdoor.
Yeah.
And in France, Fred Glow started already a few years before the Enduro Series events. And we were like, wow, that's... And of course, you know, the Mega Avalanche, the founder of the Mega Avalanche, which I forgot his name for a second, but it's going to come up. You know, they were developing these gravity-fed events, but where you still had to pedal. Either you had to pedal up to the top or take a lift and do these super long downhill stages.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred launched the Enduro with the Tribe 10,000
right.
in Val d'Alos. Can you imagine a race where you go for 2 days up on a lift and you do 10,000 vertical meters drop in 2 days?
Wow.
Like your hands on Sunday night don't want to even hold a fork right. anymore. So those bikes were made, and in fact, the Commensal was perfectly in time, you know, with the development of the sport.
Mm-hmm.
But it was nothing like that in Italy. So Franco came to me and said, Enrico, we need to do something. We need to launch Enduro in Italy. And I was like, come on, Franco, I'm too busy. I, you know, my down events, my other things.
Yeah.
Short, long story. He convinced me.
Yeah.
And we did two test events in 2007, Priero and Cartosio, just to test the format.
Mm-hmm.
And the main thing was basically to be able to find a format, and that was Franco's idea, that was suitable to Italy,
mm-hmm.
where we don't have that many lift access mountains and terrain as in France.
Okay.
So the rally format came up, basically the format that we know
mm-hmm.
nowadays, and that has been, you know, sort of a foundation of Enduro
right.
as we know it today. Because if you want to, and that was always our goal, if you want to organize an enduro race everywhere where you don't have a lift, you need a format. And that's how we started.
Yeah, that's interesting, because here in the U.S., I feel like our idea of enduro is more that Italian idea where, you know, it there are no lifts. And to us, it seems weird when an enduro race has some liaison stages that, you know, give you lift access. So yeah, it's really interesting how kind of the sport evolved to fit into those other locations.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, it was exactly the type of riding that we've always been doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you go out for a ride with your buddies and you go up on a mountain, down in a valley, up on the other side and down, you go up and down the whole day. And, you know, and you have fun and you challenge your friends on the way down, usually. Mm-hmm. That's at least the type of riding we like to do at the time.
Yeah, that's very cool. So how has the Super Enduro changed over the past 10 seasons? I imagine there's been some tweaks to the format, and you mentioned a little bit earlier, but sort of how has it evolved over the years?
I think more than in the format, we evolved based on the evolution of the technology we have today from the industry. Bikes are way more capable than what they used to be. I mean, a few weeks ago, I think AWS posted a gallery of pictures of the very first AWS in Punta Ala 2013. And when you look at the bikes, oh my gosh, like, it seems like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think mainly the evolution has been on course design and what the speed of the bikes and the riders, you know, evolved over the years. As far as formats, we still like to throw in the mix some Alpine events whenever we can. And that means lift access. So you can have a Super Enduro race, let's say in Punta Ala, where you have to pedal up the hills and go down. And, you know, we have to limit to 1500, 1800 meters climb on the race. Mm-hmm. But if we go to La Tuile or Abetone, where we have lift, we can do maybe 500, 1000 meter climb and maybe 3000 down.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, we try to adapt the format that is flexible to the location and basically to tell the story and to express the type of riding that that venue, that destination is known for.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, how you frame like sort of the beginning of Enduro as coming from the bikes. You know, there's these bikes and what do we do with them? How can we race them? But there were others working at the same time with Enduro, you know, and it was being driven by the sorts of trails that people ride or the athletes and things. And I think that just speaks to the power of Enduro, the staying power of it, that it's being driven from all these different angles and it continues to evolve. And everybody has kind of a different perspective, but it's become this thing that really drives a lot of the innovation and change that we're seeing in our sport.
I think so. And I think it's really great to be open-minded and, you know, always look at new ideas or, you know, new formats or just a new approach from organizers, from venues, from riders, and be open to accept and evolve with the ideas that are coming together from different perspectives.
Yeah. Well, speaking of being open to new ideas, you know, the Enduro World Series, of which you're a board member, recently announced that there's going to be new e-bike categories for 2020. Are you thinking about doing the same for the Super Enduro Series in Italy?
Boom. That's this is going to be a pretty big big topic. Well, actually, we opened already to e-bikes at the Super Enduro as let's say as a category. As race in the race.
So they were riding the same trails in the same field, just they were scored separately.
Exactly.
Okay.
And honestly, Jeff, I don't think it's like the perfect setup, the one we have at the Super Enduro, because I really feel I've been e-mountain biking for now 6 years already.
Okay, wow.
Pretend to have some sort of experience, at least as a rider. And I find e-bikes completely, it's a different sport than mountain biking. Don't get me wrong. Like, you know, we use mainly the same components and, you know, we can ride the same trails, but the kind of experience you have on an e-bike, it's a different thing. So I feel events and races should reflect that part, these new possibilities. At the Super Enduro, though, we decided to be inclusive. You know, Franco in 16, he decided to stop with the Super Enduro and he started the e-Enduro, the e-Enduro series in Italy.
Yeah.
You know, developing a format specific for e-bikes, which I think it's great. But what we wanted to do and we wanted to achieve at the Super Enduro, and because there's a lot of people that want to stay together and enjoy these events that are traveling around or bringing people around our beautiful country as a discovery of the unique taste mm-hmm. of Italy that is very different from region to region, from even from village to village. We wanted people to stay together, so we wanted to be inclusive for e-bikes. And if you remember in the beginning, you know, when e-bikes basically hit the market, people were, you know, not really friendly, or, you know, there was some big argue on e-bikes, even magazines like still.
Yeah, still in the US, especially, yep.
But we don't wanted to be in a ghetto or send e-bikes to a ghetto. Why should you attend, you know, an e-bike specific event?
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to open the Super Enduro to everybody just to enjoy the event and the format, knowing that in some of our stages, an e-bike was suffering way more than a normal bike,
yeah.
than an acoustic bike.
Well, yeah, I'm curious. I mean, we talked to Chris Ball about this, and I'm curious to know, do e-bikes have an advantage? Where did you see the people who were on an e-bike posting faster times than those without?
In some stages, yes. Top athletes that ride e-bike, I think for sure, at like the actual technology, e-bikes are not too far back over normal bikes.
Hmm.
I think there's even some advantages in weight distribution of the e-bikes, you know, center of gravity
uh-huh.
over normal bikes. And we saw that in one event where the fastest time in few stages were on an e-bike by a pretty fast guy.
Yeah. And to be clear, when we talk about the times on stages, these are descending stages. This is going downhill, not climbing, not really taking advantage of the main advantage of an e-bike, which is pedal assist.
No, 100% descending, or even with flat parts where you can push an e-bike to 25 km per hour,
right.
but not really go a lot faster above that. Whereas with a normal bike, you can easily push to 35 or 40 pedaling.
Right.
So we were honestly, Jack, we were a bit not afraid, but, you know, shocked by this information and data. Yes, we were.
Yeah, interesting. So what are some of the challenges of promoting such a prestigious race series that, I mean, I imagine it takes up a lot of your time and it's a big production, right?
It is. And, well, thanks for the prestigious. I take it as a big compliment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not enduro. It's super enduro.
It is. And, you know, that have always been since the beginning, our main goal. And, you know, because in the beginning, we wanted to position enduro as something that people have to notice.
Mm-hmm.
And understand, we tried to partner since the beginning with, you know, big sponsor. We had Volkswagen, you know, the vehicle company, the German brand supporting in the beginning. And that helped us a lot to position the Super Enduro as sort of the reference. Then over the years, and for a few years, we tend to control all the events. We didn't want any other organizer to start enduro until they knew exactly how to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a consumer, well, and as organizers, we didn't want anybody to get in touch or touch base with an enduro race and be deceived and, you know, mm-hmm. leave a bad experience. And actually, I always use this food metaphors, cooking a good enduro race, I mean, you need good ingredients and you need a very good chef.
Right.
And in the beginning, the risk was too high that something was going wrong for new improvised organizers. So we tend for several years to control the whole market and train organizers and explain and talk to them and, you know, take them by hand into the organization until there were enough very good organization around the country. And, you know, we sort of released, you know, other organizers and let people do more events.
Mm-hmm.
And that created a very big movement, I would say, in Italy, with more than 10, I think it's this year, regional series.
Oh, wow.
So we have the Toscana Enduro Series or the Sardinia Enduro Series or the Lombardia or the Triveneto. Like, all the region, they have their own regional series.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can focus on the national series. And that creates the base of, you know, the grassroots events, create the base for, you know, new riders for the discipline.
Yeah. So 10 years ago, when you were first starting out with the series, was it difficult to get people to sign up for the race? I mean, did they understand what enduro was and why it was going to be fun?
We partner with a magazine. It was a Tutto Mountain Bike at the time. And, you know, they helped us a lot to explain to their audience what was enduro. And we invested a lot since the beginning. And I think that has been, you know, one of our strengths in the beginning, investing a lot in communication,
mm-hmm.
and media, good pictures, videos, you know, all this content that actually self-explain
right.
the discipline to people.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's hard to explain an enduro race by words. It's easier with pictures and videos.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you had your first ever race cancellation this spring. What led up to sort of making that decision? And was it a hard decision for you?
One of the most difficult days ever as a race organizer. Even in the old downhill days, you know, I went through storms and, you know, lightning that, you know, broke the timing. I mean, I went through some serious stuff, but had to cancel a race because nobody expected the snow on top, and quite a lot of people were not really well equipped for that event. It was a very tough decision. Probably, you know, the best decision we could take at the moment or at that moment. But, you know, it suddenly reminded me about the EWS in Latuil in 2014,
mm-hmm.
when during the practice day, we're going up to 2,600 meters, and it was snowing and wind up to 50 k per hour, and the perceived temperature was like -5.
Whoa.
And our riders of the Enduro World Series was going up on the lift with just a super light jacket. And we're like, guys, this is serious mountain.
Yeah.
Like, you need, you mountain bike, you need to be aware that, you know, one of the elements, or actually the elements, is the nature, the outdoor, and, you know, the weather can change suddenly, and you need to be prepared. Even if you are racing an event, you always need to consider this factor. And I think this year in Pietraligure, we live kind of the same experience. And, you know, we had to stop to rescue people. So we had all the medical team basically helping people with, you know, freezing.
Oh, wow.
instead of being ready for rescue along the stages. So, you know, we had to take this decision, but it was a tough one. Yes, for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, it sounds like it was the right one, because safety is obviously probably the most important thing that you have to do as a race organizer.
Absolutely.
So all four races in the 2019 series took place in Liguria and Tuscany. Do you have plans to return to the Alps for 2020?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. I can't tell you. I don't know. I don't know when, you know, you're going to publish the podcast. Maybe the calendar will be already out or not, but we're returning to the Alps. Yes, we miss the Alps. Even if we had, you know, a stop in Abetone. And Abetone is a ski resort in Tuscany. It's actually an incredible place, because from, you know, the top of the lift, on top of the mountain, in a beautiful clear day, you can see the Florence Dome.
Oh, wow.
Yes, exactly. the Giotto Chapel. So, you know, it's in Tuscany, but they do have, you know, some good mountains. But yes, we're going back to the Alps in 2020 for our last event.
Yeah. Does the weather in the Alps, is it more unpredictable? Does that worry you at all?
Yes and no, because I mean, when I look back, about Pietralicola last year, it was April the 7th and, you know, the paddock and, the village, basically where, you know, we started the event, we were on sea level and we were going up to 1200 meters on sea level and we had a snowstorm. So I should say, yes, usually the mountains are more unpredictable. But on top of that, let me add that this crazy weather and climate is becoming more and more unpredictable. That's why I think organizers and racers need to be more flexible with their equipment and plans.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I mean, that's a big part of enduro is balancing that, you know, with having a lightweight bike and a lightweight kit with having everything that you need. Because like you said, it is a serious event and you're in remote locations a lot of times on mountains that can be very unforgiving.
We are. And again, Jeff, that's mountain biking, actually. How many times we find ourselves, you know, in the middle of valleys and mountain, maybe on a 2-day adventure, and you need to be ready. Mm-hmm. And, you know, an enduro race is, I think, kind of reflecting the same type of experience, or at least we'd like to think it that way. And we try to design our events to be adventures on their own and discovery of the area. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you own your bike distribution company, Wimp. Is that right? Wimp?
Yes. For Wimp. For Wimp. Yes.
For Wimp. Sorry. All right. For Wimp and Super Enduro. And you're also on the board of the Enduro World Series. How do you find time to do all of those things?
Incredible teams. I think that's, you know, that's the key to read what I do. I have a business partner in for Wimp and yet a very good team that, you know, carries all the daily duty of a distribution company and challenges. Same at the Super Enduro. The Super Enduro is a group of people. And, you know, when we're on event, we're like 14 people, as a staff that work to produce the event. And I'm still enjoying it a lot, you know, my announcing, but I also care about several other factors and things during the Super Enduro. Mm-hmm. And on the EWS, just a board member. And again, EWS has an incredible team of people. We just met like last week in Scotland for sort of a yearly, you know, debrief and meeting and of course, dinner, Christmas dinner party, which is always great. And, you know, everybody has been working so hard to produce and deliver what we deliver. And, you know, all the teams are not like big. I think there's not a misunderstanding, but, you know, sometimes you think like, you know, behind EWS or Super Enduro, there's huge amount of people. There's not. There's a lot of good, committed people. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Teams are important, really important.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really cool. So what plans, if any, do you have to attract more women to enduro mountain bike racing in Italy and beyond?
Let's stop talking about women as they were women. Mm-hmm. As simple as that. Like, you know, I think there's, it's a big topic, but you know, as long as we think, oh, you know, women need to do easier things. You know, we need to care about, you know, something specific for women, women bike products. Like there's not such a kind of thing in other sport. Of course, there's a specific needs in terms of equipment for some things. But let's start to consider women like we do for all the other matters in life and topics and work and daily, you know, life. There's women way more, you know, capable and stronger and fast than men. So I think we just need to stop considering, you know, women as a separate category.
Yeah.
Let's just get together.
Yeah. It sounds like your approach maybe is put on a great event that people will enjoy, and that will mean men and women will be interested in it. Do you think there are certain things that are keeping women from doing enduro right now?
I think if there's one discipline that is accessible, is enduro. Of course, if we expect women to, or beginners, or you know, people with a low level of skills to show up at Enduro World Series and embrace that and be comfortable, no, not at all. But I feel like, especially if you attend like a regional event or a local event, you know, and liaison time are pretty more relaxed, and you know, the stage design is not too extreme, women, like men, like youth, like older people, can get into those events and grow from there to a higher level. The other thing is mountain biking. I've always been more of a male-driven sport.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have this sense of, oh, you know, it's extreme. You go out, the mud, the rocks.
Yeah.
Who cares? Like, you know, you go to Whistler. You go to, and I consider Canada, for example, a way more evolved country into mountain biking than many other countries in the world. And the level of riding that women have in Canada, it's amazing. It's, I can't keep up with, you know, a lot of women my age or even older that are just kicking my ass.
Right.
So again, let's just have fun together. Just go. And if I need to walk, I can walk. Or if, you know, my girlfriend needs to walk, she's going to walk.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a good point that everybody needs various entry points into the sport. I mean, none of us would think that we can just kind of start enduro racing and be at the top of the sport. I mean, we need opportunities for, you know, easier level tracks and, you know, less competitive races and things like that to sort of build to that level. And it sounds like with the Super Enduro and the EWS, there are more and more of these opportunities every year.
I think so. Totally.
So what are your thoughts on the recent doping suspensions of several enduro mountain bikers?
That's a tough one. I think there's, again, it goes back to the age of enduro. And when I'm talking age, enduro is still a young discipline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been doing Super Enduro for now 11 years, and it's going to be our 12th year, and Enduro World Series is only 7 years old. And, you know, the whole scene is young. So our riders, the racers, and the pure Enduro racers, I think they don't have the education that cross-country riders or road racers or cyclocross or even downhillers had over the years.
Yeah.
Like if you're a top tier athlete in any other discipline, your federation and your team, you know, you have regular blood control and blood check over, you know, the season, over the off season. And you have, there's a kind of a protocol you need to follow. And there's way more education into that disciplines than in enduro.
Mm-hmm. You know the rules. I mean, you come up in the sport knowing that there are these rules and there are things you can and can't use. And, you know, if you're going to try something, you need to talk to a doctor and have them look up the rules for you and all that sort of thing, right?
Exactly. And your coach, your team teaches you and provides you all the guidelines to, you know, to actually, and you grow with that information.
Yeah.
I think enduro just hasn't come to that point. So, you know, we had a case in Italy, and of course, you know, the most famous Ricci and Martin. And I think all of them they all share the same path, or, you know, the same problem of not knowing exactly what to do. And I think the key is education. And I was having, you know, before those cases, I was having a chat along a liaison during a practice day on one of our races with some riders coming from cross country. And, you know, we're debating the fact that even among riders, there's not a lot of talk. There was not a lot of talk about how to manage, you know, the potential substances that you take for anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have a flu and you take one of the medicine that I always take as a normal person, you know, to cure my flu. But if I'm going under a the anti-doping control, I probably result positive to that element, which is something I take, you know, over in winter, at least I get a flu every year.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's just a matter of education, Jeff. I don't think there's any, honestly, I don't think there's any, you know, bad.
Bad intentions. Yeah. I mean.
Yeah. Bad intention behind it. Yeah.
I think that's a really good point too, about how the sport is so young and, you know, this provided, unfortunately, to the detriment of these athletes, but it provided education for everybody else. Now everybody else in the sport knows that you need to be careful and you need to understand the things that you can and can't do, or else you'll end up like these guys. It's almost as if they're made an example to kind of, you know, set those expectations for everybody else going forward.
Absolutely. And, you know, to that regard, I don't know if you talk about that with Chris or Darren or someone else, but, you know, as EWS, we organize a sort of public conference. It was a rider conference in Canazei, mm-hmm. with UCI and, you know, with the guy responsible for the doping protocol at UCI. And basically the goal of that night was education. It was just explaining to the riders what are the rules, what are the protocols, what you need to take care of, and, you know, what you need to pay attention to. And I think it was a very good step. And, you know, we don't pretend to educate people, but I think as a group of people working together with the same goal, organizers, industry, riders, media, we all need to be aware that education is always key for a common goal. And so, yeah, it was very interesting. I've learned, like, personally, I've learned a lot that night.
Yeah, I think we all did.
Yeah.
So do you feel like enduro courses are difficult enough for top-level athletes, or are they going to continue to grow steeper and more technical as equipment improves and also as the athletes improve?
I think it's an evolution that we're going to see in the future. I don't like to see enduro going too extreme or, you know, being too far from the roots of the sport. I think an enduro race, it still need to be rideable by a good level rider, not racer, but rider, as a trail of his Sunday ride.
Yeah.
And of course, it changes and it varies from place to place, terrain to terrain. What we saw this year at EWS level, but even at the Super Enduro on a different scale, we saw some bold moves from riders. And that means that, you know, the level of skills and fitness and riding of those guys is improving. So it's good to challenge them, you know. But then, you know, it happened to me, like, at some point, I was like, okay, we're going to go, you know, down this trail and, you know, we're going to tape here and there. And then a rider made a line that was like, what? It was possible, you know? And so I think that, to answer your question, yes, there will be still an evolution, but I don't like to, you know, send a message that something is too extreme for a normal rider to be able to ride it with different speed. Of course, a racer goes over obstacles and trails way more faster than what I can do, maybe what you can do, but it's fine. As long as we can ride the same trail, I think I'm fine with that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, would you say, it seems like when you're designing a course that you might want to, say, make it more difficult if all the times were, say, really close to each other, right? Like, everybody is essentially taking the same lines and it's just kind of down to seconds between first and second. So are you seeing that in enduro? Are the times at the top of the pack getting closer together, or is there still a pretty good spread between, you know, first, second, and third?
We had this year, we had, I think, two races at the Enduro World Series and even at the Super Enduro, but Enduro World Series mainly, with gaps less than half a second at the end of the race. Like, wow. Yes.
You would expect in downhill, but enduro, that seems unusual.
It seems unusual, But that, to me, that means that, you know, writers are really pushing hard. And I don't think, you know, the writers are kind of choosing the same line. I think down a stage, down an enduro stage, you know, Sam Hill versus Florian Nicolai, the big battle of the year. I think they're all picking up different lines, and they're strong. Like one rider is strong maybe in one passage or one part of the trail, and the other is stronger on another one. What makes enduro super interesting? Because, you know, sometimes you look at the stages and you're like, oh, he's going to lose a stage. And then he wins with 2 seconds. I'm like, wow, why, where? So because of the diversity of trades that are, you know, we mix together in an event, in a race, there's never a big advantage for one guy or the other. But at the end of the day, they come so close together because they try to excel in every little part of the stage. So we didn't expect that, but it makes things super crazy interesting, Jeff.
yeah, very exciting. Well, Enrico, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and for everything that you're doing to sort of push this new form of mountain biking and to make it even more exciting and better for everybody.
Well, thanks for having me and good chance to, you know, talk a little bit about my story, and hopefully we're going to ride together somewhere.
Yes.
Sometime.
Absolutely. Great. Well, you can find out more about Super Enduro at superenduromtb.com, and be sure to check Singletracks for more information about enduro racing and some of the backstory about how the Enduro World Series got started. That's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week.